Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to review most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. A classic two-guest lineup today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Kate Lossy. Lossy spent 5 years working at Facebook and has a lot of thoughts about Facebook exec Sheryl Sandberg's version of feminism, which is getting a lot of attention, at least in some circles. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from the historian and journalist Ahmad Shoker, who's been living in Cairo for the last couple of years. He'll be talking about Egypt's economic troubles and the impending deal with the IMF. No time for any comments on the economic news today, except to say that there was another of those one-day strikes against fast food establishments in New York City on Thursday, of the sort we discussed here with one of the organizers a couple of weeks ago. I'll have a report next week. First up is Kate Lossy. She's the author of an excellent review of Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, that appeared on the Dissent magazine website on March 26. Sandberg's book, on which more in a moment, has made quite a splash, at least in some quarters, as a kind of corporate feminist manifesto, a subject position that's not surprising, coming from someone who worked for Larry Summers at the Treasury in the 90s, and then went on to become one of the most prominent women in the Silicon Valley, first at Google and now as chief operating officer at Facebook. Kate Lossy was employee number 51 at Facebook, not a charter member of that enterprise, but pretty close. She worked there from 2005 to 2010, ending her career there as a ghostwriter for company founder and majordomo Mark Zuckerberg. Last year, she published an excellent book, The Boy Kings, on the experience. That experience gave her a great perspective on Sandberg's feminist project. But before we get into that, I do want to talk about Sandberg's book and its reception. That reception has been amazing to watch, with the liberal feminist intelligentsia, writing in places like Salon and Slate, pounding out encomia to the book's charms. It's gotten some critiques aside from Lossy's, a sharp one by a former Behind the News guest, Melissa Gerard Grant, for example, for its intense class bias. Sandberg's book is pitched to professional women working in a large corporate environment. It's mostly about attitudes, like self-assertiveness in the workplace. While this is far from worthless advice, women can be unjustifiably shy about their merits, just as men can be overly boastful about theirs. This is very limited in its scope. She has little to say about politics and policy. Hers is a largely individualistic prescription. And she has next to nothing to say about or to the vast low-wage female workforce. Grant pointed to this absence in her review. The absence of any concern with domestic labor, for example, that makes the upper corporate lifestyle possible. But the liberal feminists have dismissed these critiques as hating and bashing. Grant was taken to task for guilting Sandberg for hiring nannies and other, mostly female servants. But it wasn't about personal guilt-tripping. It was an illustration of Sandberg's class-blinkered view of the world. It's as if the liberal feminists feel liberated by Lean In. They don't have to worry so much about the gendering of the occupations and industries, or systematic sex pay discrimination, classic concerns of feminist economics. They can just feel pumped up about asserting themselves. To appropriate a point from Adolf Reed, this is, in the end, a class politics, a politics of those who want into the upper reaches of American society. Of course, if there's going to be an elite, it shouldn't be constructed via sexually and racially discriminating practices. But even a fairly constructed elite is still an elite. If you don't care about class stratification and simply want a piece of the action, Sandberg's book is for you. Sandberg has started an organization to promote her agenda and wants women across America to form lean-in circles. A visit to their website, leanin.org, which is just one little letter away from being lenin.org, imagine that. It features some reflections on learning to speak up by Condoleezza Rice, who, while undeniably a woman, and black as well, has served at the highest levels of the imperial machine, which is apparently the kind of thing we're supposed to admire. A visit to Lean In's partners page reveals that the project is backed by such public-minded sorts as American Express, Bain Capital, BlackRock, Chevron, Credit Suisse, DuPont, GE, Harvard, and yes, Walmart, targeted the largest sex discrimination suit in human history. Okay, now on to Kate Lossy. Her memoir of her time at Facebook, The Boy Kings, is splendid, full of smart observations and very nicely written. She's more optimistic than I am that companies will see the light on gender equity, but I wasn't in the mood to give her a hard time about that. Kate Lossy. Welcome, Kate Lossy. You write in your review that Sheryl Sandberg has written less a feminine mystique kind of book and more a Protestant ethic in the spirit of capitalism. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think people have received Sheryl Sandberg's book as being primarily about feminism, which it is to some degree. But what I'm exploring in the Dissent article is the way in which Cheryl's book aligns with actually a kind of work ethic that is going on in Silicon Valley, sort of a new idea of how we work and how we should be working. And I see her book actually being as much about that as it is about feminism and women in the workplace.
What kind of vision is it of our work life or life, capital L?
I think it's an idea that work has this value that is almost transcendent, that devoting ourselves to the companies, especially these, new tech companies that are perceived to be very innovative and exciting, is really where we find value in our lives, and that there's really no end to that kind of work that we can do for them, and that's where we should be sort of devoting our energies and as opposed to devoting them to other things.
Now, what about the gendered angle? I mean, she's urging women to be more assertive, lean in. What kind of effect would that have in the corporate structure that you saw?
Well, in my book, The Boy Kings, about my experience at Facebook, much of the book is about the sort of structure of value in some of these tech companies, which, from the outside, the idea is that they're completely meritocratic and everyone has an equal chance. And while that's true to some degree, I noticed that there was a very sort of heavy structuring of, which types of labor were valued, who was imagined to be sort of the brilliant innovator versus other people in other roles that may not be perceived that way. So I'm questioning, in this idea that all a woman must do is to lean in to her company, I'm questioning the ways in which the company needs to value women's work and needs to correct for situations in which a woman's work may not be valued highly, and so that the woman, rather than asking the woman to do all the work to correct that, that companies can actually do that some of that work themselves to say, where are we falling down? Where are we failing to value this person's labor the way that we're valuing someone else's?
I have to say that the picture you paint of Facebook strikes me as just dominated by an adolescent boy culture that never grew up. It's really appalling in a lot of ways, of real socially undeveloped characters. And while they have formidable technical skills, it's not a very inspiring kind of environment to an outsider. I mean, what did it feel like for you to be there?
I had mixed feelings about it. I thought that this idea of being innovative and cutting edge is something that we all can respond to, and that was kind of exciting, this idea that you're building something new that no one's ever used before. And I think that was easy to get behind. But I also saw the way in which that allowed for a lot of more traditional aspects of the company to remain traditional. So if you think that you're hacking everything and you're always on the cutting edge, you don't really have to look at the ways in which the company you're building is actually repeating a lot of things that, you see in very old school traditional companies like on Wall Street and so forth. So you could have, big income disparities, inequities in how employees are treated, and as if you think of yourself as being so innovative, you can't even see that.
Now, the innovation, did people think about what the innovation was about, or just the technology really become the goal in itself?
That's a great question. I think I didn't see a lot of reflection about, what does innovation mean? I think it's often coded purely technically. So simply building something new and having that scale really quickly and making sure that site stays up and that it doesn't break becomes like the idea of what innovation is. Also this idea of sort of continually growing, continually moving outward into new spheres of people's lives, of technologies that people use, that's sort of what innovation looks like in the Valley. But it's not so much about social. It's not thinking about, how do we actually want to transform our social lives? Do we want to transform them technically, which is how Silicon Valley thinks about it, or do we want to, think about it more reflectively, more deeply about how we want to lead our lives in our social interactions? That's something that I don't think it's thought about as much as the technical side.
Yeah, well, Facebook is all about sociability in some sense, which is something that women are usually thought to be good at. But in this case, this is a lot of it was a very masculine, particularly, I hate to use this word because it's overused, but a kind of autistic masculine idea of sociability in which people felt more comfortable with screens and with human beings.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that's actually one of the most fascinating things about this sort of social technical revolution that has basically occurred over the past 5 years, where you know, many people are looking at Silicon Valley as a place where social work is being done in this weird way, which if you're in that world, you see that, you know, while these tools can be very useful, they also, by doing everything technically, there are a lot of things that get left aside, a lot of more intuitive human ways of interpreting the world and interpreting change in the world that are not happening when you conceive everything as a technical revolution.
Now, there are social scientists who say that, that the idea that this kind of, you know, mediated, technologically mediated sociability leads to the fraying of human relationships, and some people say they lead to their enrichment. Do you have any thoughts on what kind of effects this mediated sociability has on life and in meat space?
You know, I think one of the things I think the book is sort of subtly cautioning people, my book is cautioning people to do, is to think, you know, at each moment that you reach for the phone to do something, think about what you're not doing. So there are many ways I've noticed in which, you know, going to see a friend and having a conversation with them is a much more satisfying and a richer experience than sending them a text message. And the thing with, you know, Silicon Valley is that they're monetizing the technical interactions. That's where the value comes from for these companies. So, you know, when you make the choice to do something technically as opposed to in person, you're not just sort of potentially losing something yourself, you're also providing value to a company that you're probably not getting that value back from necessarily if you're not a shareholder. So, you know, people should just be aware of the way in which this technical progress is definitely benefiting certain groups, but not necessarily the individual all the time.
Now, the workplace you entered very early, what, Facebook employee number 51?
Mm-hmm, in 2005.
So you got to see it pretty much from the beginning or very close to it. What was it like being a woman entering that kind of environment? Did it seem just very testosterone-laden from the outset?
Yeah, I mean, it was challenging. And fortunately, I mean, I'm somebody who it wasn't totally foreign to me. You know, I have lots of male friends, and it wasn't something that was, you know, impossible to deal with. But it definitely was a bit like, you know, going into a frat house. There's a lot of guys around, and you kind of have to make sure that you can get along with them, that you know how not to trigger certain issues. It's kind of a finessing situation that you have to do when you're in a situation like that where you're in the minority. And, you know, the company did grow to have more female employees, but the departments are quite segregated by gender. So, you know, I was, by several years into it, I was in the engineering department, which was hugely male. There was a time when I was the only, I think I was one of three women on an entire floor in the office. So it's definitely an experience, basically still like that, from what I understand from people who work there still.
But curiously, Facebook seems to be, the central thing is pictures of women. Women like to look at pictures of women. Men like to look at pictures of women. That's really what it seems to be mostly about. What's that?
You know, and I think that's one of the ways in which Facebook needs to recognize where its value is coming from. And it's absolutely true that for whatever reason, you know, women's photos, the pictures that women take and the pictures that are taken of women are the thing that people actually like to see on social networks. So that's one reason where if I were running Facebook, I would want to acknowledge that value and sort of make sure that women, whether they're working there, whether they're users of the product, are being, you know, treated with respect because and being valued, because that's really the source of the value for the company.
Mark Zuckerberg, I mean, he's very much in charge of the thing, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He has a majority of the company, and you know, as most of the people that I worked with don't work there anymore, and so there's this turnover, you know, within the company, but he remains at the top.
And he really does seem to have the ambition to have information on everybody in the world. I mean, there seems to be, and I always resisted the argument that there's something sinister about this information gathering, this voluntary supply of information to all these servers somewhere. I used to resist the notion there was something sinister about that, but reading your book made me think that maybe there is.
I think it's a question that we have to ask. I mean, that's sort of the question I was asking while I was in the company and thinking about what this meant for the world. And I think it's just a question about power, right? Like in any system, when one person has a lot of power, you know, we want to make sure that we're keeping tabs on that and that we're not giving up too much, because it's not that, you know, the person in power is necessarily bad. It's just that you never, you know, that when there's a power imbalance, when one person has too much, that can be a problem.
And do you participate, or have you gotten away from Facebook?
I mean, I have an account. I use it, but I found that some of the other technologies, the social technologies that have arisen, allow you to do different things. Like, I enjoy the conversations that I can have on Twitter. You know, Instagram is kind of fun, although that's now a Facebook product, in keeping with this idea of sort of, you know, keeping the territory. I look forward to new technologies arising. I like to try them out. Having been in a company like this, it helps me to sort of try to understand what these companies are doing and how they're doing social technology, because they all end up doing them in slightly different ways, which is interesting.
I'm speaking with Kate Lossie, who spent 5 years at Facebook and wrote up the experience in an excellent book called The Boy Kings, and reviewed Sheryl Sandberg's corporate feminist manifesto, Lean In, for Dissent magazine. Now, to get back to you, Sandberg and her vision of life, it's almost as if it's the unmonetized life is not worth living from her point of view. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, we also have to remember how wealthy she is. So there's a way in which, for her, it's possible that working itself is the value, because she doesn't have to work. But I think most of us find that we're not in that situation when we're working, where we're not getting all of the value back necessarily from the labor that we're putting into our company. If we're not, you know, have many, many shares in the company, like executives do. So I think that she's arguing that there is this, that if we just keep pushing ourselves, we will reap all of these rewards. And I think that's possible for some people. I think in some cases, people do reap many, many rewards from being, you know, a very, very hard worker and rising up in a company. But I think we have to question that as a proposition for everybody. And we have to wonder why the executive of a company is telling us that is the way that we can best improve our lives, is to just keep, you know, pushing forward and charge and giving more and more of our labor to the company that we work for. I think that there's got to be some kind of pulling back on that, in a sense, to say, wait, you know, I want to put as much work in as I think makes sense for me, for the company, for this role, for what I'm being paid to do, and for what my, you know, future prospects are in the company and without.
Well, how much does she have to offer women of modest means, more ordinary folks than centimillionaires like Sheryl Sandberg?
Some of her advice I think is useful. You know, she has this idea of sort of faking it till you make it, which I actually used in my career, where there were certain moments where I could not complain because it was going to cause too many problems and create too much tension, and so I had to sort of keep going and just pretend everything was going to be fine, which for me, you know, it did end up well. And I think that advice can be deployed in certain situations, you know, intelligently. If you think about it, you know, you really weigh the options. Sometimes that can work. But I think we want to question whether it's the woman's role to do all of the work emotionally and internally to, you know, make her career a success. I think if the company values its employees and values women employees, it needs to also, you know, reach out to them and make sure that they're being treated fairly and equitably.
But she, her presence near the top of Facebook really didn't seem to change the sexist culture very much.
It was more on a sort of one-off basis, which is funny, because in engineering, you're never supposed to do anything on a one-off basis. You're supposed to do it scalably. And so, you know, I would have preferred to see, you know, a sort of very scalable renovation of the pay structure. Like, why do women occasionally have to make less than men? You know, I cite a situation that happened to me where I was told that I could not have it raised because I'd already had my salary had already risen too much, even though it was still under what my peers are making. So I think those are situations where if you looked scalably at the whole system and said, why would we say that to a particular employee? Why don't we correct for that across the board? That's a scalable way of fixing pay inequity. But instead, it was more like correcting individual situations where one individual was behaving badly. And I guess I would argue that companies should take an engineering perspective on this and say, no, we should fix everything across the board. We should figure out why there are structural problems in terms of women's pay and fix those.
when Facebook sees a rival developing, it will either try to build its own to preempt it or to buy the rival. But what they want to do is, you know, prevent any serious competition coming from outside. Now, you drew an analogy with Sandberg's book and Facebook's fear of a feminist critique. Some people found that rather over the top. So could you lay that out and explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that I'm interested in is the way in which Facebook as a company is sort of moving into new terrain that's not traditional corporate terrain. So they have, you know, first of all, the product has a domain over, you know, people's personal lives. It's not just technical. They have lots of information about people. This is part of their business model. And what we're starting to see is Facebook moving into new territory. So they're developing a PAC to have some government influence, and then now we have Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In organization, which aims to be a feminist social movement. So we're seeing Facebook sort of steadily move outward. And I'm theorizing a way in which one reason they might want to have a social movement, a feminist social movement, is to protect from critiques that come from outside the company about the ways in which Facebook may not be feminist. So the example of the fact that, you know, women's images drive Facebook, Facebook has not acknowledged that and has not said that they have, you know, they place a particular value on women's contributions. So that's a critique that they're vulnerable to. But by having an in-house feminist social movement, they can brand themselves as being, you know, a leader in feminism. And so it's a way of, you know, like Cheryl once told me, it's offense, not defense. You know, you put forward a social movement so that, you know, an external social movement cannot say that you are sort of lacking in that area.
She's certainly gotten a lot of attention and a lot of applause from liberal feminists who like what she has to say. I mean, were you surprised by the attention and success that this book has gotten?
No, I haven't been surprised. I mean, obviously, Facebook is a huge media presence. Even though it thinks of itself as a technical company, it's really also a media company. And so this is kind of, you know, the fact that they would have, that Sheryl Sandberg as the executive of Facebook would have easy access to the media establishment is not a surprise to me. And, you know, also she's a huge business presence, so, and you know, media is a business. So there's a lot of synergy, I think, between the mainstream media and Facebook as a media company, and they want to kind of stay on each other's good sides. So it's no surprise to me that there's been such a huge media blitz in support of the book.
But do you think this is going to translate into some sort of social movement? Will we have a CEO-led social movement like this?
That's a great question. I don't know yet whether the actual movement that's imagined or that Sandberg is proposing is going to happen. It does seem that, you know, the great thing about all of this is that there's lots of discourse going on right now about feminism, about technology, about all of the intersections between these things and women in the workplace. So I imagine potentially it will just be more of a, you know, greater dialogue, more people being involved, maybe not necessarily in Lean In, but in feminism, in these issues. And I think that's actually a really great thing.
Would this world be better off if there were more people like Sheryl Sandberg?
In what way?
With the work-centered vision of life that she has.
I would hope not to live in a world where we all had to be that way. I think that we all know what's right for ourselves, like whether we want to devote our entire lives to work or 90% or 80% or less. And we all have to make choices with regard to, you know, family, work, and our personal life, which I think is important. So I think there's a place for the kind of work ethic that Sandberg espouses, but I would not want that to sort of have to be applied to everybody at all times. I think that may end up benefiting the companies more than it benefits all of the workers in that case.
That's Kate Lossy, author of a sharp review of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In on the Dissent magazine website, and of a memoir of her 5 years working at Facebook, The Boy Kings. Though I'm a very active Facebook user, I've got to say that her book made me think twice about what it's all about. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Human robot. Human robot.
of some of Robot Rock by Daft Punk, a favorite band of the Facebook engineers during Kate Lossie's time there, performed several years ago at the Coachella Festival, a favorite destination of Facebookers. Next up is Ahmad Shoker, who's a graduate student in Middle Eastern History at NYU and an editor at Egypt Independent. He's been in Cairo for much of the past couple of years, covering the revolution. Egypt's economy is in bad shape, with the currency sliding, reserves dwindling, and Egyptians finding it difficult to afford the basics of life. That's not what all those people in Tahrir Square were agitating for a couple of years ago. Here's Ahmad Shoker to tell us what's up. I do apologize for the audio quality of the cell phone signal, but it's getting harder to find people with landlines these days, especially when they're in Cairo.
So Egypt is now on the doorstep of the IMF. How did the country get to this state of desperation?
So there's been talk about an economic crisis in Egypt for the past 2 years, since the toppling of Mubarak in 2011. And domestically, it seemed like every time there was a political standoff between the opposition and the regime of the military, the army responded by stoking fears of an impending crisis and blaming it on the persistence of revolutionary protests and so on. But now it seems like things have actually gotten pretty dire. Egypt is facing two immediate problems that it will have to deal with over the next few months. There's a growing budget deficit, and there's a balance of payments deficit. The budget deficit may reach as high as 13% of GDP this year, which is around $30 billion. And the country has also been facing balance of payments difficulties due in large part to drops in tourism and foreign direct investment, and thus contributing to the depletion of Egypt's foreign exchange reserves, which have been used since 2011 to support the value of the Egyptian pound, in addition to its usual functions, of course, like imports and debt service payments. So these are the immediate problems that Egypt faces. But if, you know, these economic problems in Egypt that I've described are often blamed on post-revolutionary instability, but they have deeper roots that lie in the way that the Egyptian economy was structured under Mubarak, especially over the last 20 years. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. In general, we could say that since 1991, Egypt saw an acceleration of neoliberal policies that included large-scale privatizations and rolling back of social protections. But it was a peculiar kind of neoliberalism whereby the state offered resources and assistance to cronies and investors who were close to the regime, but at the same time maintained a minimal level of sort of economic populist policies that would enable ordinary Egyptians to remain at a basic threshold of survival and the logic behind this was to avoid the possibility of a popular revolt. So the state subsidy program was a good example of how the system worked. Now, on the eve of the revolt that toppled Mubarak, the Egyptian state was spending nearly a quarter of its expenditures on subsidies, mostly for fuel, and these subsidies were unfairly biased towards the rich. So whereas over a third of fuel subsidy spending went to serve energy-intensive industries in which private investors had come to play a greater role since the privatizations of the 1990s, a smaller amount went towards assistance that actually benefited the poor. And subsidy spending dwarfed expenditures on items that could create social mobility like education and healthcare, which, got only a fraction of the state's budget. So the function of the subsidies was to ensure basic survival, not social mobility, for the poor, while giving unnecessary support to the rich who didn't need it. Now, additionally, by the mid-2000s, under a new government of Western-educated reformers who were close to the president's son, Gamal Mubarak, the program of privatization was accelerated, and Egypt increasingly adopted a strategy of economic growth led by foreign direct investment. So FDI flows reached a peak of, I think, $11 billion in 2007 before taking a hit with the 2008 economic crisis, and growth, economic growth reached as high as 7% in those years. And while much of that growth was benefiting foreign investors and private sector cronies, very little of it was reaching ordinary people because the regime did not invest in mechanisms that would allow for that. So, for example, it did not invest in safety net programs, minimum wage legislation. It did not allow trade unions to operate freely so they could engage in collective bargaining. These things were all absent in Egypt. And there was no strategy to ensure that investments were directed towards labor-intensive industries that would create jobs. So, you know, the result was that a lot of money went into sectors like oil and gas and that sort of thing. And, of course, you know, all of this triggered a major backlash. So, you know, over the course of the 2000s, Egypt saw a wave of labor protests, you know, the largest social movement the country had seen since the years before the Second World War, in which, you know, over 2 million workers engaged in strikes and collective actions of different sorts. You know, many of them against privatization and you know, some of them around, you know, wage issues, benefits that were held back by employers and that sort of thing. So the crisis that Egypt faces today is really the result of the structure of the economy under Mubarak that made it vulnerable to shocks, like a sudden drop in tourism or ethnic flows, as well as the kinds of economic decisions like refusing to modify a socially unbalanced subsidy system that were taken in these years. And the political leadership post-2011 has only exacerbated these problems, first under the military and then under a Muslim Brotherhood presidency, by being unwilling to take any radical steps towards changing the economy that it inherited from Hosni Mubarak. Instead, they've relied on short-term solutions like cash injections from abroad, mostly from the Gulf, or you know, the central bank using its foreign exchange reserves to prop up the value of the Egyptian pound. You know, they've relied on these short-term solutions to maintain a system that's no longer sustainable. So that's where we're at today.
The foreign direct investment flows, what sectors do those flows go into? Is this part of an export strategy that didn't really work out?
Yeah, no, I'm having trouble hearing. I mean, I think you were asking about, you know, what kinds of industries saw growth in those years. I mean, like I said, oil and gas, you know, saw a lot of the growth. There was also growth in real estate. But like I was saying, there was never a plan to divert investments into, things that would actually, that were labor intensive and that would create jobs and the possibility for some kind of trickle down. And you know, interestingly, you know, today we're seeing the same sort of vision coming out of the new government led by the Muslim Brotherhood, where much of the talk is about you know, restoring economic growth rates, pre-2011 economic growth rates, boosting investor confidence, making Egypt you know, a place where business will feel welcome, where international capital will be able to come and do business. But there's no vision for how this would translate into, you know, any kind of model for inclusive growth, what mechanisms would be put in place to ensure that whatever growth is created under this vision would benefit a wider segment of the population. That's, you know, we haven't heard very much from the government in that regard.
The system of subsidies that prevailed, what was subsidized and how did it benefit the rich disproportionately?
So the main things that are subsidized in Egypt are fuel and foodstuffs, most importantly wheat. Egypt had a much larger subsidies program that originated in the 1970s, ironically, because many people will often attribute the current subsidies program to Nasserism in the 50s and 60s. And, well, yes, there was a subsidy program in this period that increased noticeably in the 1960s. The subsidies program really took off in the 1970s under the liberalization policies of Anwar Sadat, which were known in Egypt as the open-door policies. And the thinking back then was that you know, the government needed to subsidize, you know, a fairly large bundle of basic commodities in order to placate the Egyptians who are being left out of the open door or the liberalization project, particularly public sector employees who, you know, were making demands for higher wages and that sort of thing. So this is where, you know, the origins of the current program, one can say, begin. And then, you know, throughout the 80s, it was gradually slowly but gradually trimmed, and what remains of it today takes up, as I said, about a quarter of the state's budget. The main items are fuel, which is the majority of the subsidies, and wheat. In the fuel subsidies bill, the largest item is low-grade diesel fuel, which is about half of the fuel subsidies bill, and the majority of that diesel fuel goes to energy-intensive industries, so things like cement factories, fertilizer factories, that sort of thing, you know, many of which were opened up to private investors in the 1990s. You know, one of the leading cronies of the regime under Mubarak, who was you know, notoriously close to his son Gamal, and was a leading figure in the former, now disbanded National Ruling Party, Ahmed Aiz, was a steel magnate who operated a monopoly in steel. So I mean, these are the kinds of industries that you know, benefit the most from the fuel subsidies. Whereas, you know, other things like cooking gas, household consumption, you know, kinds of fuels that are used for household consumption, you know, get a lot less money in the subsidies program.
So these weren't doing much to address people's basic needs.
No, they weren't. I mean, it was basically a blanket subsidies from which you know, rich people and investors benefited enormously. You know, people living in cities benefit a lot more than Egyptians who are living in the countryside. So there was a big problem with the way the subsidies program operated. And like I said, the diesel fuel subsidies are really the core issue, right? Because they take up an enormous amount of the overall subsidies bill in Egypt. And Egypt also imports a lot of its diesel fuel, so it contributes to the current account deficit and in turn the balance of payments difficulties that I described earlier. So in a sense, the, you know, diesel fuel is the big elephant in the room. And the policies, as I said, operated in a way that, you know, many ordinary people, you know, were able to benefit from, but the program was not directed towards the benefit of ordinary people, nor was state spending in general geared towards creating social mobility.
I'm speaking with Hamad Shoker, who is a graduate student in Middle Eastern history at New York University and an editor at Egypt Independent. He's been in Cairo for much of the past couple of years covering the revolution. Now, there's a tale that the central problem of Egypt's economy is corruption. Is that a fair charge? Could you take that apart for us?
Yeah, although, I mean, the kinds of things I'm describing also have to do with economic policy choices that were made by the regime, you know, around issues of yeah, how entitlements and responsibilities were distributed. They're not, I mean, to you know, classify all of Egypt's economic troubles under the rubric of corruption, I think is a bit misleading. Now, that said, you know, kleptocracy issues have also been a big problem under Mubarak. There's no secret there. And while in the initial months after the revolution, there seemed to be an effort on the part of Egypt's new leaders to go after select members of the old regime, particularly those who were affiliated with its younger reformist wing, whom I described earlier, there seemed to be an attempt to go after them and press corruption charges against them, and you know, many of them have actually ended up in prison. But now the government seems to be you know, changing course. They've been under the Muslim Brotherhood. They've been accelerating efforts to reach out of court settlements with Mubarak era businessmen, both foreign and Egyptian, rather than seeing that they be held accountable under the law for any possible violations. You know, there's also the issue of wealth that was illegally transferred abroad during the Mubarak era, which is estimated at around 130 or just over 130 billion. And unfortunately, there hasn't been much political will in Egypt to begin pursuing any of these kinds of things. Yet there seems to be an appetite for making ordinary Egyptians pay for a fiscal mess that they didn't create through, you know, new sales taxes and the kinds of policies that will be associated with the IMF program if it goes through.
What were the relative contributions of economic complaints and political complaints to the revolution of a couple of years ago? Was it really a lot of economic discontent or discontent over political repression? What were the relative strengths of those causes?
It was a mix of different things. I mean, it's really hard to identify one or two factors and say that these were the primary reasons that prompted people to take to the streets in 2011. It was really a mix of different things. You know, there's no doubt that social and economic grievances were fundamental, but, you know, there were also a whole host of other grievances against the security institutions, against police brutality, you know, against corruption, and a desire to see a regime that, you know, had ruled them for 30 years and done all of these things, you know, be held accountable by people for once. So, you know, I would hesitate to reduce the motives of, you know, millions of people literally who took to the streets to a definite set of factors.
Is there a sense that things have really changed markedly over the last couple of years, or is it meet the new boss, same as the old boss?
No, I mean, there's a sense that things haven't changed very much. I mean, like I said, you know, many of the kind of basic structural problems that existed in Egypt under Mubarak. I mean, I talked about the economic ones, but you know, more broadly, I mean, many aspects of the regime continue to exist as they did in 2010. Many of the ministries and state institutions are effectively run by the same people. The military still plays an important role in political life. And you know, you can even see this with the negotiations over the IMF loan. I mean, the key government institutions that have been negotiating with the IMF over this loan over the past almost 2 years now are institutions that have undergone virtually no changes since the Mubarak era. I mean, the finance ministry is still by and large the same ministry that it was. The central bank, the international planning and cooperation ministry. I mean, these are the institutions in Egypt that play a very important role in shaping economic policy and that have been at the center of the negotiations with the IMF, and they're virtually the same people.
What about the popular energy that led to the revolution of 2 years ago? Is that still bubbling, or have people just given up? What's the state of popular feeling now?
Well, I mean, I think there's a sense of fatigue, definitely, on the part of wide segments of Egyptian society, who were probably a lot more enthusiastic about the possibilities that the uprising presented 2 years ago. But that said, I mean, there's always pockets of resistance against authority everywhere. Their grievances and demands may vary. They might be articulated in different ways. You know, they're not always out on the streets calling for regime change. But these pockets of resistance continue to exist. I mean, we just saw a rebellion in the city of Port Said along the Suez Canal in Egypt just a few weeks ago against the security authorities and the new regime. You know, worker strikes continue to happen. You know, smaller scale protests against police abuse are ongoing. So, you know, there's still the process that was unleashed, so to speak, by the 2011 uprising is still very much unfolding, and you know, it hasn't we haven't in any way reached a conclusion yet.
And what would an IMF loan mean for Egypt?
The IMF loan? Well, Egypt's been trying to negotiate a budget support loan with the IMF for nearly 2 years. Now, the value of the loan as it stands would be $4.8 billion, and the idea is that it would unlock up to $14 or $15 billion in funds from other potential creditors like the World Bank and the African Development Bank and the European Union and so on. Now, like I said, Egypt is currently running a budget deficit that's likely to reach 13% of GDP by the end of the fiscal year. And you know, like I said previously, a lot of government spending goes towards things like salaries for state employees, but also, you know, many other things that don't benefit most Egyptians, like debt service payments and subsidies that are heavily tilted towards people who don't need them. So Egypt needs to undergo a process of fiscal restructuring. There's no disagreement there. But the question is how to do that and who will pay for it. Now, the IMF would like to see a deficit, would like to see the deficit brought down through a combination of tax hikes, mostly on consumer goods, and spending cuts, beginning with fuel subsidies. Egypt came very close to concluding the deal with the IMF last November, but it fell apart at the last minute when the Egyptian government reneged on a plan to raise taxes on a bundle of consumer goods that included cigarettes, alcoholic beverages, pesticides, cooking oils, fertilizers, all sorts of things. Now, last month, the government presented a much more moderate version of the reform proposal with more modest tax increases, and the IMF was reportedly unsatisfied. So as it stands, the government is still working on completing a reform program that can gain the IMF's approval. An IMF technical team is supposed to visit Egypt tomorrow, and it seems the main sticking point in the Egypt-IMF talks is the pace at which the reforms will be implemented, not the substance of the reforms themselves. There seems to be broad consensus within the IMF and the government that deficit reduction is a primary goal in the coming period and should be achieved through an austerity program that will involve tax hikes and spending cuts, mainly on fuel subsidies, as well as greater exchange rate flexibility, which we've already seen in the last few months. But how quickly will this plan be implemented and what are the benchmarks in the coming period? These are the matters that remain to be worked out. And though IMF officials talk a great deal about how the institution has changed, how they now promote inclusive growth, how they've come to realize that macroeconomic indicators don't tell the whole story and that they don't reflect the hardships ordinary people face in their lives, you know, Christine Lagarde, the IMF's managing director, said words along these lines last summer before her visit to Cairo. What we're seeing is many of the same old policies that privilege macroeconomic stability over everything else and that promote deficit reduction through austerity. And the ongoing negotiations seem to be about the new Egyptian leadership trying to get away with as little and as gradual change as possible with regards to implementing these kinds of policies while still securing the loan from the IMF. Now, though the government's reform program is yet to be finalized, we're already getting a taste of what some of these policies will look like. So yesterday, for example, the government raised the price of state-subsidized cooking gas cylinders by 60%, which are mainly used by the poor. It's a move that was probably intended to demonstrate their commitment to deficit reduction through austerity ahead of the IMF's visit on Wednesday. Now, critics of the IMF and the government reform program, like myself, have called for a different program, one that would distribute the costs of fiscal restructuring more fairly, including levying more taxes on those who have the ability to pay, more progressive income taxes, for example, higher taxes on select business activities, as well as subsidy reform that will ensure real protections for vulnerable groups and mechanisms to protect against inflation, which is becoming a big problem in Egypt. And so far, the government doesn't have a plan for achieving any of these things, and it seems like we're heading in a direction where the costs of fiscal restructuring will be shifted largely onto the middle and poorer segments of Egyptian society.
That was Ahmad Shoker, who's a graduate student in Middle Eastern History at NYU and an editor at Egypt Independent. He's been in Cairo for much of the past couple of years covering the revolution. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Some of Revenge by the Mekons, for no other reason than I love this song and the way Sally Timms sings it. Till next week, bye.